All right. Let's hope I have a nice big booming voice. All righty. Very good. Okay. Good to see everybody. As you know, we're in our study on the gospel. I'm just going over a couple of lessons, a couple of things as we get ready to get into some of the meatier, weightier portions of this. On Sunday and Wednesday, Brother Kenny Mars is going to do a lesson on Galatians chapter 3. So, is that correct, Kenny? Galatians 3? So, I'm going to ask that you read that between now and then. Read that and have that ready. A week from Sunday, Brother Tyler Brown will begin our study on the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. He'll be looking at four lessons or more to take us through that. And I've asked Tyler to really get into that, ask some good questions, and get us thinking here. I have a question for you for tonight's class. And the question is, do we really see Jesus? Now, let me help you out with that a little bit. Do we really see Jesus in light of God's eternal plan? Do we see Christ in His death, burial, and resurrection? Do we see, maybe I could rephrase that, do we fully understand, comprehend what He has done for us? And the reason why I ask this question is there's always a danger. And let me use an example of biblical authority. What is one of the reasons why we visit the subject of biblical authority? Why do we continually do that? We do that frequently here. Why do we constantly come back to biblical authority? What's the reason behind that? Anyone? Why do we... Jeff?
Because it's always being tested.
It's always being tested. All right. And Dave?
I was going to say because it justifies the way we do things.
That's right. Is there any danger? Should we not visit that subject enough? What are the dangers? What do we need to be worried about if we don't spend our time looking at the scriptures, studying the subject? Yes, Wes?
Well, the danger is we think we're saved because we do things the right way.
There we go. That's right. I look at that, and that answer is right. I look at that in the same way I'm asking this question. All right? It's been over 2,000 years since these undescribable events took place that changed mankind. God's eternal purpose, all the way back to Genesis. All the way back to Genesis. We finally see that come to pass in the Gospels and in Acts. And in 2,000 years, a lot could happen. Steve, did you ever hear that?
Yeah, what I was going to say was the reason we check to make sure we have authority to do things is, you know, when we study the Old Testament, we see what happens when people have done things that they did not have authority for, like touching the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
Just tons of things in the Old Testament that people were punished because they didn't have authority to do the things that they did. And we learned from that in the New Testament that we need to have authority for things that we do and in our worship service.
Right, exactly. And that's why we visit the subject, because it's so easy to get off track. I want to apply the same idea to this idea of, do we really see Jesus? And what I'm getting at is, over the course of 2,000 years, can we get a misunderstanding who Christ is? Let me put a question out to you. How does society today view or interpret Christ? What are some places that they place Him in that He doesn't belong? How is Christ viewed? Yes, Wes?
A good man.
Okay, he's a good man. I don't disagree with that, but that's about where they leave it. What else? Yes?
Only a prophet.
Only a prophet? Alright. Dig a little deeper. Yes?
You can have the impression that he had a lot more political opinions than he did.
Okay, now you're getting warm. Alright, he's got a lot more political opinions. What else? Yeah, Nick? Right? Yeah, 2,000 years, what's going to change, Greg?
You know, so he's a lot more, he thinks more like me than
Right? Right? Anything else come to your mind? The relevance of Christ? Yes, David.
Some people might consider him to be a swindler if they believe that what he did was true.
Sure, sure. I'm going to share with you a list of things that were written by a gospel preacher, acquaintance of mine. I'm borrowing his list here because of it. He did a study on, he actually called it, Do You Know Jesus? So I'm going to borrow that. But he kind of puts it in perspective of where our minds tend to go. And let me just get right to the point, and I'm going to come back to it in a moment. Is if we lose sight of who Jesus is, if we really can see him through the scriptures, obviously I'm not talking about a physical, we all know that. But if we lose sight of who he is, what he's done, all right, we lose the gospel. We lose the message, we lose salvation. And if we're not careful, and this is the danger, if we're not careful, we might find ourselves off track or adopting an idea of what we think or who we think Jesus is or what we think he does and go through our whole life and be misled. So let me share a couple of these with you. I did not write these. I didn't borrow all these, but I thought they were kind of interesting. He wrote these and he says, there's the patriotic Jesus who is wrapped up in our flag. Thereby, the assumption is all that we do must be blessed by God. I think some of these are spot on. I think some of these, if we're not careful, we get caught up on. All right. That, you know, one of the things that I see sometimes is I hear sometimes that the United States is a blessed nation. Right. And we get the idea that what? What's the dangerous idea we get sometimes about our country? Yes?
We can do no wrong.
Right? We can do no wrong. Well, yeah, we can do no wrong, but Carolyn?
That we're God's chosen people as a nation, not as a church.
Right? That we're God's chosen nation. We are a special, peculiar people. There's the political conservative Jesus who is against budget increases and stands for family values and owning firearms. I'm not trying to be silly here. But sometimes there's that idea that I heard something the other day, God, guns, and country. And that's our nation. Well, that's dangerous. That's dangerous to adopt the thinking that Christ is involved, is part of this. Another one that he said is there's the Starbucks Jesus who drinks fair trade coffee, loves spiritual conversation, drives a hybrid, and goes dumpster diving. All right? The idea that Christ is there at your local Starbucks. Here's a couple others. Oop, wrong one here. There's the open-minded Jesus who loves everyone all the time, no matter what, except for people who are not as open-minded as you. Some people get the idea that everybody loves Jesus until that person does not have the same mindset as myself. There's the touchdown Jesus who helps athletes run faster and jump higher than non-Christians and seemingly determines the outcomes of Super Bowls. Once again, it's not my intention to be silly. It's something that we see and hear all the time. And it's a perception of Christ that people throw out there. And if that affects us, or it can, we begin to not be able to see the real Jesus and who he is. There's the red carpet Jesus who helps Christians and actors win prestigious awards. There's the spirituality Jesus who hates religion, churches, pastors, priests, and doctrine, would rather have people finding the God that is within us all. There's the guru Jesus, a wise, inspirational teacher who believes in you and simply wants you to help you find your path in life. And then finally, there's the good example Jesus who shows you how to help people, change the world, and if we want, become a better you. And you can look at all these and you could say, well, there's a little bit of truth to some of these, all right? But in reality, there's none. And these are all the things that I see, and there's a lot more I could look at, and other areas we could look at, that causes me concern that I don't want to lose sight of who the real Jesus is. I don't want this to affect the Christ that died for my sins. I want you to open your Bibles now, if you would, to John chapter 12. Let's go over to John chapter 12. And if somebody would read 21 through, let's go through 24. John 12, 21 through 24. Who's got it? John 12, 21 through 24. Who's got it for us? Dave?
So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit."
Okay, I have a question for you. This is the question the Greeks asked. So I want to use this question to kind of launch our study tonight. What did that phrase mean, "we wish to see Jesus"? What did they mean there? "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Let's see what it looks like. What were they asking? What were they seeking? Thoughts? Dave?
Well, it could have been anything from, "We want to see the famous guy," or "This, we want to see this guy who's doing all these crazy or interesting things." Or they could have had spiritual motives as well and thought, "Wow, we've heard about all the things that this person is doing, and we want to see for ourselves if he has some supernatural powers."
Any thoughts? Do you think? Yes, Jeff.
My thought is that the reason they went to Philip, I mean, they could have seen him like everybody else. They went to Philip because
right.
they wanted a face-to-face. They want a meeting. They just don't want to be in the crowd. They want an opportunity to meet with Jesus.
Okay. Was there a purpose behind that? To what? To asking questions? Think? Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. I think it goes beyond just seeing his face. Yeah, they were out in the crowd. They wanted to see Jesus. I think David made some good points there. They wanted to see who he was, all right? They wanted to inquire about these things. And of course, the term here means more than just view merely with the eyes. I think it carries the idea of an investigative quality. All right. It's like, I want to see, I want to know, I want to ask questions. All right. And I've heard a lot of sermons on this. "Sir, we would see Jesus." And I'm always reminded in many times in those sermons, just the simple point of coming back that we would see Jesus and who he is, what he says, what he has done for us. Notice in verses 23 and 24, still of John chapter 12. All right. What Christ does here is disclose to his disciples that he is about to bring life through death, is what he's going to do. And what we need to do or understand is we need to understand Christ, or I should say, view Christ or see Jesus, look upon him through cross-shaped lens, or just through a lens. We need to be able to look at Christ through the gospel and nothing else. When I put up those statements earlier that were rather ridiculous in some cases, when you stop and think about it, all right? When you stop and look at that, sometimes that's how people try to look at Jesus. They try to look at him through some kind of simple friendship. Through the American flag or something like that, rather than looking at him through the cross. I remember at Florida College, in my brief stay at Florida College, there was a class called the Scheme of Redemption. I didn't get to take the whole class. But the whole class, the Scheme of Redemption, takes you from Genesis all the way through Revelation. And what do you think the main focus is? The Scheme of Redemption. God's eternal plan. Brother Homer Haley wrote a great book years ago called The Eternal Purpose and the Covenants. I recommend that book, where he takes you through a study of Christ and the cross and God's purpose through that. And when we look at this and we examine this, this is how we have to look at Jesus, I believe. Always through the cross. And I think that's important to understanding or getting this clearer understanding of the gospel and who Christ is. Because like I said, if I lose sight of who Christ is, then I'm afraid I'm going to miss some things. I'm afraid I'm going to miss some things when it comes to the gospel. So we want to look at Christ through the cross, or through the cross. Now, here's what I want to go tonight. I want to go to Isaiah 53. I said all that just to get us to Isaiah 53. I want you to open your Bibles to Isaiah 53. It's a rather short reading. Actually, we need to look at 52:13 through 53:12. Is anybody up to reading that for us? The whole thing. Grant, please. So let's go 52:13 through 53:12, please.
Starting at 52, verse 13.
Yes.
Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up, and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days, and the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors.
In my opinion, one of the most beautiful yet difficult descriptive writings of Christ. If I might add, it was beautifully read. Thank you. I meant to have us just really take it in as Grant read that. Time won't let us do a deep expository on that, and that's not my intentions, but I want to make some observations of this, because when I ask the question, do I see Jesus? I believe this is what we need to be seeing. I believe this is what needs to be our visual or our mental when we think about who Christ is, and we look at that, and we talk about the idea of the gospel. As you look at this, I want to highlight a couple things, and we'll start breaking down the chapter and make some observations. When you look at Isaiah 53, there's a list of things that kind of jump out at you, and if I miss any, please share them. First of all, one of them is the ministry of Jesus. We see in this Christ's mission to reach, seek, and save the lost. We see his rejection by man. His cruel rejection by man and his trial. We see his torture and his trial. The things that he went through, the pain that he endured. And as I mentioned, I'm asking Tyler to spend a little bit of time on that. We see his death, burial, and resurrection. We see his intercession for us. Sometimes we use the word our mediator, our go-between. We see his intercession. And of course, we see the salvation for mankind, and we see what he has done for us in this. Isaiah 52 and 50, or through 53 is often considered one of the servant songs. In fact, if you go back, you could go back to chapter 42, chapter 44, chapter 49, 50, 52, and there's a what we would call the servant songs. And it, if you follow that, it reaches its climax in chapter 53. All right, that's the full climax of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. And each of the servant songs contains a series of meditations on the ministry or the servant servitude of the Lord who is to be the Messiah. A couple of things that stand out. Isaiah repeatedly emphasizes the servant's repulsive appearance and pitiful state. Look at verse 2 of chapter 53. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Why? What makes that? Let me rephrase this. What do people normally look for in a king or a leader? What do we look for?
Pleasant to the eyes.
Pleasant to the eyes? What else do we look for? Yes, Carolyn. Right. Right. You notice as the writer here is describing this, he's taking us through things that I don't want to say we don't understand, but at first don't add up. He's going to contrast suffering and glory here in a few moments. He's going to give us a contrast between the two. All right. He talks about this individual who is not pleasant to look at. Look at verse 14 of chapter 52 that Grant read. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance and his form beyond that of children of mankind. What is that? What comes to your mind when you read that? It makes me wonder if he was taken beyond human recognition. I don't know. But this is the idea. This is the picture that we're getting. Yet in this passage, Isaiah describes Christ's suffering and shame. He also affirms his glory. Here's his suffering and shame. Then he affirms his glory. Here's this unattractive, suffering servant, and he's going to prosper. He's going to be satisfied. He's going to vindicate over in chapter 53, verses 10 through 12. Then now we see what I call a cross section between his suffering and glory. All right, so let's look at this for a moment. I have a question. How can a person's suffering be considered glorious? Because that's what we just read. How does a person's suffering, Dave?
Well, we all have seen lots of remembrances today.
Yes.
About many people who suffered and were glorified and still are being glorified as a result of that. So sacrifice has a lot to do with it.
Right. What else? Has to do with the sacrifice. What else? How can a person's suffering be considered glorious? Isaiah's going to tell us, Dennis.
Well, he's going to tell how he reacts to that suffering.
All right.
Now, whether it strikes back or deals with it.
Right. So, I think the yes, Roy?
Because he accomplished everything God wanted him to accomplish. That's all.
All right. Very good. Boy?
Someone's suffering can be considered glory when it benefits someone else. Like the very last sentence in verse 13, he made intercession for the transgressors. That's how his suffering became glory.
Right. So put all those together. If the person suffering is the servant of the Lord, if his, this is what I think Roy just said, if his suffering accomplishes the world, the, excuse me, can't speak right tonight, the will of the Lord, then it cannot be anything less than glorious. That's the point, all right? And so if you watch, Isaiah just slowly kind of breaks this down and puts it back together for us as we try to understand this. Because like I said, in human terms, this is why it's so difficult. Even myself, I struggle with some of these things sometimes. Wes?
I think there's also an aspect we see in here that Jesus didn't come to be glorified by people while he was on this earth. He talks about how we esteem him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. People saw him on the cross and thought, he's getting what he deserves.
Right.
He must not be the Messiah. He must be some shyster, a sinful man, because God wouldn't do that to the Messiah. God wouldn't do that to his servants.
Right.
And of course, this prophesies about that. So Jesus didn't come to get all this glory from people. And that was part of, I think, the temptation of Satan when he was in the wilderness. That was the easy way out.
Right.
He was cursed. People thought he must have been the worst thing in the world because of seeing him on the cross. That was a shameful thing.
Right.
And it wasn't about him doing what he wanted. It was about fulfilling God's will and saving us.
Exactly. Well put. Roy?
One of the last things he said when he saw the light was, it is finished. It's complete.
Right. Everything's done. That's exactly right. I had a thought. Just lost it. If I come back to me. His suffering, again, was nothing that would be attractive to us, I guess what I'm trying to say. All right, and I think that's the point you were making, that it was not attractive to us. Suffering is nothing to be desired, but we read that it is the will of the Lord to crush the suffering servant. I'm not going to get into that and ask what the will of God is. I don't want to get into that. But it's interesting that when you read that phrase, the will of God, what does that tell you? What is that telling you? It was God's plan. That's what he's saying. It was God's will, and this was going to happen no matter what. Even if Peter jumps out in front and says, Nope, you're not going to kill my Savior. No, get behind me. don't get in the way of God's plan. And that's a beautiful picture here when we look at that. This is God's will. This is God's will for us because this is what we need. This is what we need as God's people. And again, the suffering and glory are not contrary to God's redemptive plan. They're essential components. When you look at God's saving grace, when you look at God's saving plan, we have to see that suffering. We have to see that sacrifice. I don't know what Tyler's plan is, but one of the things that went through my mind too in preparing for this study was maybe doing a little bit of time just talking about the blood in the Old Testament and making a connection between the blood in the Old Testament and the blood of Christ to help us have a deeper appreciation for this. As you look at this, any questions, comments as I'm going through this? Yeah. All right. Let's go ahead and let's look, kind of break down the text a little bit. Let's look at verse 3, or 53, 1 through 6. And I love the way the writer starts this. Who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? What is the question here? Is the writer saying, who is this person? What is this writer saying in this? Who has believed our message? Let's see. What's he saying there? Kind of a rhetorical question. When you read that. Thoughts? Yes, Grant.
I think it's similar to what God kind of said to Habakkuk. When Habakkuk kind of was complaining, and God said, I'm going to kind of accomplish something in your days that if you saw you wouldn't believe it. If you were told you wouldn't believe it.
Right.
They're sitting there saying, rhetorically, nobody's believed what I'm about to tell you.
That's right.
You wouldn't believe it.
That's right. Jerry, did you have a thought?
Yeah, along the same lines.
Okay. And why wouldn't they? We've kind of touched on it. Why wouldn't?
That's what God's going to do is unbelievable.
That's right. That's right. What's going to take place is unimaginable. All right. I mean, who would have thought that God would use this method to redeem humanity? Right. I mean, we could probably sit here and go, I can think of another way, but no, this was beyond our comprehension. This was beyond anything mankind could come up with. And perhaps that's what makes the beauty and the uniqueness of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection so important. And you look at this, and to Grant's point there, you look at this and you say, all right, who would imagine this? All right? But if you go over to Acts chapter 8, beginning about verse 25, who do we come across reading the prophet Isaiah? The Ethiopian, okay? The Ethiopian, all right? And what portion is he reading? Pardon? Yeah, he's reading out of Isaiah. And what is the question he asks? That's right. And then what does Philip do? From that point, he preaches the gospel. Or I'm going to say, he preaches Jesus. From that point. So you go, you fast forward how many years from this writing. All right, who would believe this? Who would, and what's happening now? We get in, and we can get into Acts. We can look at a number of examples. I'm just using the Ethiopian as an example here because he was reading from the prophet Isaiah. Look at John 12, verse 38, real quick, where Christ uses the same. Let me just get there. 12:38. I think I got it here. So that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be filled. Lord, who has believed what has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Second part of that question I meant to ask. What is meant by the arm of the Lord has been revealed?
Power.
Pardon?
Power.
His power? All right. Anything else? Yes, yes. Okay. I see. Yes, Grant.
Well, you go back to verse 37 there, and it says, though he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. So Isaiah is telling me back in his day, even though that God has revealed his arm, I mean, he's revealed his arm, his power to Israel for
right.
centuries at this point, they still don't believe what God does for them in Isaiah's day and won't believe in the future. And then sure enough, in Jesus' day, Jesus is revealing his arm constantly.
That's right.
And they don't believe it.
Exactly. You get to Christ's day and they're still rejecting. Exactly. It doesn't change. I mean, you can even bring back Moses. Bring them all back. They're still not going to believe. Good point. A couple more things in verses 4 through 6 that I wanted to point out here. We won't get through this. As you read that, he has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. We esteemed him stricken, pierced for our transgressions. Do you notice the inclusive our and we? Just kind of little things I'm pointing out. The inference is what? That's us. I think that applies to us as well. It applies to them in their day, and it applies to us. Now you might look at that and say, well, wait a minute, I'm not rejecting Christ. We did at one time. When? I'm not asking the date. But there was a time in our lives where we rejected the servant. What state were we in? Sin, right? Okay? As long as we were in sin, as long as we were in that relationship, all right, then I believe we rejected this. Now he goes on to be a little bit more descriptive of the case, what happened that we read in the Gospels. As you look through this, and I think some of you have already pointed it out, Wes, you did a good point, you made some good points there, that what we look at and what we understand here, getting back to that idea of the cross, The cross was a common Roman death, and as you pointed out, here was just somebody else dying. Just somebody else on the line of crucifixion. Somebody else coming along. All right? And they looked at that and they viewed that, as we've been saying, they viewed that in such a way that he must be cursed. No son of God would die this way. Wes?
To go back to the arm of the Lord, I think that's tied in with this. Is Jesus on the cross is the power of God.
Right.
To save us. And yet, even his closest followers saw him on the cross, and that's not what they saw. They didn't understand. They were fleeing, they were afraid, they were in shock.
Right.
They couldn't believe what they were seeing. I think that's what this goes back to. The power of God to save people is going to look nothing like what we would imagine.
Exactly. Look at 7 through 11 now. All right. Notice what Christ gave up as we look at this. All right. Let me put it this way. How is his innocence described here? How is the innocence of Christ described here? Yes.
As a lamb brought to the slaughter, and as a sheep, he was mute. He did not fight back. So he was totally humble in what he had to go through.
Exactly.
And I heard my mother, who grew up on the farm, talking about sheep. And when they were sheared, they did not try to fight and get away. They went very humbly and meekly to their shearers.
Right.
And that brings that home to me more.
That's exactly right. And that's the description that the writer here offers. You said the word there. The word there is humility. Again, as we look at this, his compliance, maybe that's not a good word, but his... Really, are we out of time?
You have five.
Do I have five or am I done?
You have five.
Okay. Okay, great. I'll have to talk to that deacon about giving two bells before it's time. I know him personally. I'll take care of it. So as you look through this, again, what is implied here is his innocence. And made explicit in verse 9, and they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. He was not once, and this gets back to Nola's point, not once did he speak up in his own defense in this case. Yes, he answered Pilate. He made some answers. But not once did he try to stop this. All right? And why is that? Well, one answer is it was the will of God. All right? I mean, you go back to the Old Testament and those, you talk about the sheep being quiet, going to shearers. All right? And these animals being drug in to be slaughtered and sacrifices offered. All right? The difference is, yes, Roy. Right.
Jesus said, "You don't have any power except my heavenly Father's giving you."
Right. That's exactly right. He puts it right back in their lap, is what he does. We got about 3 minutes, so I'm gonna stop there because I don't want to get their next section. There's got some questions, but let me just put a couple questions out there for us to wrap up our study. So somebody asks you, why did Christ die? How would you respond? Ever sat in a Bible study and somebody just says, why did Christ die? I've had that in this Bible class with some of these younger kids. Wait a minute. Why did Christ die? How do you answer that? What's your response? Al?
To reconcile us with God.
Okay. All right. Reconciliation. What else, Phil?
To save me from hell.
Save me from eternal damnation, hell. Carol?
Because he loves us.
Because he loves us? Yes, Wes?
It was God's will.
It's God's will. That's exactly right. And that's the question that I think we always need to ask ourselves. Why did Christ do what he did? And not say, oh, I don't know what the answer is, but to remind ourselves and repeat the answer back over and over. Okay, we'll wrap it up there. So on Sunday, I have Galatians chapter 3 ready to go, memorized, whatever it is. And I'm looking excited about Kenny's thoughts on Galatians chapter 3. Thank you.